Happening now. We'd like to welcome our viewers from across North America and around the world. This is the EdTech Situation Room, episode 295 for May 24th, 2023. My name is Wes Fryer, coming to you from Matthews, North Carolina, just outside of Charlotte, where I am just finishing up my first year at Providence Day School as a STEM teacher and media literacy teacher. And I'm joined, as always, by the EdTech Yoda of the North, who is reminding us constantly in his byline that he is pretty much human, but sometimes perhaps augmented. It's Dr. Jason Neifer of Missoula. How are you, Jason?
Good evening, Dr. Fryer. I am well, sir. And as you mentioned, I'm joining you from Missoula, Montana tonight in lovely Western Montana. And I have to say the weather's been pretty nice. It did dump rain here on Monday, but for the next at least week or so, we're going to have beautiful 70 degree days here in Western Montana. And I will say that in relatively short order, we had a really late winter this year and a late start to spring. And it's kind of suddenly turned super green here. So very exciting, beautiful, green foliage, and the lilac bushes have popped up, and they smell absolutely amazing.
Okay, but I have to ask you about like fires and weather. I've been watching some stuff on YouTube about possibly jumping into an El Nino and these fires in Canada. Are you guys having smoke, and what's up with that?
We have. Luckily, the last 2 days, it's been pretty decent. But part of the problem of living in the Missoula Valley is that once smoke hangs out in the valley, it takes a pretty significant weather event to get it out of here, whether it's a whole lot of wind or rain on Monday is really what helped us out with that. So, yeah, pretty exciting.
And this is early. It's early for that, right?
It is very early. And, you know, there is that those fires in Alberta and British Columbia, and we are seeing a ton of smoke from those. But fortunately, it's been blown out of here the last 2 days. But, you know, we've talked to the longtime listeners of the podcast. You know that, you know, late summer is a pretty consistent fire risk for Western United States, but it's particularly true of Montana. So we're keeping an eye on that and hope that first the fires go out in Canada for our friends to the north, but also that we have a relatively moderate fire season.
Absolutely. Well, we do always need to, you know, talk a little bit about things that are not show related, but this show is apparently about tech news and something called artificial intelligence. I've heard it's a new thing.
Yeah, it seems like it's getting a headline or two as of late. But hey, if this is the first time listening in, Wes is exactly correct. We like to take a look at the week's news and kind of shoot it through an educational prism to see if we can't help out folks that are interested in the use and misuse of technology in classrooms, find some clarity in this extraordinary topic. And as Dr. Fryer mentioned, we, as most weeks, have an interesting amount of interesting amount of links on that topic this week. So, other topics this week: privacy, Apple, Google, social media and tech correction news, and then, you know, in case we need it, there's, you know, quite a few links about AI this week. So, Dr. Fryer, would you like us to do one of the non AI topics to start with, or should we just jump in the rabbit hole now?
Oh, let's do a couple other ones, but we won't spend 3/4 of the show doing them. Thank you, by the way, for doing the yeoman's work there on the links. We'll remind everybody that if you're ever curious, like tonight, to see that, oh, look, Dr. Fryer didn't do jack, although I'm putting a link in now, you can see who uses the semicolons and the commas between the sources and the dates. So I am throwing a link in that I actually heard about on the Clockwise podcast, which I listened to this morning going into work. And have you heard of TeleTV?
I have not.
Okay. Well, this is an archive.today link, because those are our lovely paywall bypassing links. So this is from Wired Magazine. This is from May 17th. The true cost of a free TV. TeleTV tracks you and bombards you with ads on a dedicated second screen. It could help normalize smartphone style surveillance in your living room. And so while most of us, well, I shouldn't say that. While all of us should know that any kind of smart television is absolutely a surveillance device, and if you're not interested in being a part of the attention economy and the surveillance economy. You know, the first thing that you should do with any kind of new television is disconnect any built-in smart devices and then just like hook up an Apple TV or another device. Of course, you know, those are going to get some data for their respective companies as well. But the folks on Clockwise were saying, hey, at least this one is open and honest and saying what it is. You can get this free 55-inch TV as long as you are good with seeing a constant stream of ads on, as it says, the second screen. And apparently, if you don't switch channels and give the idea that you are interacting with it, both screens can actually become full advertisement channels into your living room. So, Dr. Neifer, are you in need of a new 55-inch TV? And will the Tele TV fit the bill for the Neifer household?
That's super interesting. The thing that I think is most interesting about that is that I do know that you can get a decent sized smart television at the Jolly Mart or Best Buy or Costco for well under $300 now. And if you buy them on sale and you don't particularly care about the quality, you're substantially under that. But what I don't get, though, is that I just try to figure out what data they must be collecting that's worth that amount to them. Because you think about it from this standpoint, right? Like, smart TVs are already collecting data on you, right? So it's not that data, because that already exists in a lot of ways, shape, or form. And yes, they're phoning you some advertisement on the second screen experience. So that's also, interesting as well. But, you know, it does talk about how it tracks a customer's queries, settings, preferences, applications, purchases, and the buttons they click, the time, the frequency, the duration of their viewing and activity. But I would also think that that happens in a lot of smart TVs as well, too. So yeah, you know, a lot of people will do a lot of pretty crazy things for free, right? Like, free is a, certainly a tempting offer, for the purposes of, you know, attracting folks. But I think we keep having to ask the conversations, what are you getting in exchange for free? It does remind me of, Wes, I'm wondering if you remember this. This was 20 years ago, 22 years ago, maybe. You used to be able to download an app for your computer that displayed an ad on the bottom of your computer. And as long as you were active, it paid you X number of cents per minute to see the ads on the bottom. And this would be, you know, the 20 years ago. So we're talking about, you know, if you were lucky, you had a 19-inch monitor, right? That was a big CRT monitor you could have in 20 years ago. I was pretty famous and made fun of by students because I used to have two CRT 22-inch monitors on my desk that were just ridiculously sized. I think we're only 1280 by some ridiculously low resolution. But that all... So you know, the typical user was using a little 14-inch monitor with an 800 by 600 resolution, and they paid you for that. And so the hack was that you could download, it only paid you while you were actively using the computer, and, you could download apps, from the internet that would kind of shake your mouse around the screen to trick it. And so for like 6 months, I would get $19, to look at these ads. And it paid for my internet. So, you know, I wasn't, you know, complaining, but it kind of reminded me of that when I heard about this.
Well, what I thought you were going to say was, wasn't it Cable One? Was that what was in it? It would put in school classrooms.
Cable One, or was it Channel One?
Channel One. It was something one. Yeah. And it was, you know, free television, but at the cost of subjecting your kids to whatever advertisements they decided to put in there. Betsy Springer, welcome, Betsy, is in the chat room, and she says, in college, we had an app for making free landline phone calls home, but it was ad-based. How interesting. On the Clockwise podcast, they mentioned, I don't know if it was Micah Sargent or trying to think of the other co-host, Dan Morin. But one of them, I don't know if they did this with a Raspberry Pi. You can do this where it's a very geeky thing, but you monitor all the upstream data that is being sent out, like from your television. So I guess they put an intermediate device in between on their internet router, they were able to monitor the port where the television was. And then they were able to see all of the packets that were being sent, and there was a large quantity of them. So yes, advertising, you know, all of us, each Facebook account, each Twitter account, all of these things are being monetized. Mr. Musk may not be successfully doing that right now, and his subscription plans I don't think are going too well for the bird site, but anyway, advertising, it continues to power a good bit of the web.
Yep, absolutely.
Any other articles you'd like to talk about before the
AI? Yeah, let's hit a couple of these Google articles. This one, I believe, is from you from last week, but apparently Google's going to start deleting inactive accounts.
Yes, and so this is good to know. At some point, many of us, I think, created extra Google accounts for different things. I actually created one a while back to segment my YouTube watching because I was having my YouTube channel sort of taken over with a particular flavor of videos I didn't really want to just dominate. But there's been some clarification articles since then saying I don't think that the YouTube videos that are associated with these are going to be deleted, but you need to log in. So if you've created something, for instance, our, you know, the Story Chasers, which is now like a passion project of mine, but for a while it was a nonprofit, and we have a Gmail account. Well, I haven't checked that in a while. So if you've gone 2 years, you know, you risk losing it. I know that Mr. Musk has been threatening for inactive bird site accounts that they possibly, could be deactivated and then given away to somebody else who's going to be active. So anyway, that may affect some of us who have some extra personal Google accounts.
Absolutely. Now, just looking at mine too, I have an old Google account I haven't been in a very, 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 very long time, and I'm just trying to get back into it now. Okay, and then one other quick Google article. This one is from Cord Cutter News on May 17th, that YouTube is now going to start showing 30-second unskippable ads. And they announced at the YouTube Upfront event last week that it will now start showing a 30-second ad that cannot be skipped on YouTube through selected connected TVs. This comes as YouTube has started to crack down on ad blockers and pushing YouTube Premium. At this time, we don't know when this will start or what devices it will appear on. They're also starting to do ads when you pause a YouTube video, which I think is utterly ridiculous. And I did kind of go on a bit of a rant about this the other day, but I find YouTube ads to be particularly awful, and it's so bad that I don't that I pay for YouTube Premium, and it's something that is extremely worth my time and money to do because it makes it such a different experience. And what I find something that's really extraordinary is that when I go back to YouTube, regular YouTube, which doesn't have the premium features with ads, I find YouTube to be basically unwatchable. That there are so many ads, they're so obnoxious, and they're not really well integrated, into the experience. And, I don't know. I feel like I think I'm paying $9.99 a month for YouTube Premium. And that also gets me YouTube Music. I've had YouTube Premium for so long that there's all these enticements that have been added on over time. And my understanding is that relatively few people are like me that have had YouTube Premium for this long, but oof. And then you add to that, if you're using YouTube in the classroom, I question, the exposure of that many ads. I think that's also a problem as well. So
this is yet another way that you have influenced me, because hearing you talk about that and also just the irritation of the YouTube ads, it just finally became too much for me. I tried to take some drastic steps of getting my own Raspberry Pi and trying to install this app that was going to try to block ads, but they're too tricky, those YouTube developer folks, to be able to bypass, ads on Apple TV and things like that. It can work on uBlock Origin in the Chrome browser, but anyway, to my knowledge, there's not some kind of open source way of doing that. But, I've had the same experience. Now, when I would go up to visit my parents and still my dad, They would typically watch a lot of television, just regular over-the-air TV. And man, not watching the ads. And then when you're in a situation where you're seeing them, it really just feels like an assault. And so I'm having the same situation now with the second YouTube account that I've created, because I'm not going to pay YouTube Premium on a second account. And so anyway, I'm having ads. But the other thing this makes me think of, and this is really a little discussed side of the advertisement world. The ads, we know they're customized. You hear about this. But for instance, I now have, you know, these two different YouTube accounts, and I'm seeing very different ads on each of them. I know that, you know, I've taught Sunday school, for a while. And so sometimes when I would be doing research, it'd be religious based. It was just very obvious that because I had had a search history where I was doing some things, you know, YouTube was, for instance, thinking, I guess I was a very strong religious conservative, and some of the things that, some of this was during elections and stuff like that. But wow. I had grappled with my friend Brian Turnbaugh about this. One of the things you got to be careful if you're going to teach students about this, you might almost have them create a separate account, because I don't think that it's good to ask somebody to do an assignment that is going to create a digital footprint for them and affect what's that called? It's not a knowledge graph, but there's some kind of a word as far as like YouTube and everything that it's gathering about you. It's possible to, you know, delete things from your watch history, et cetera. But anyway, I think, you know, what we've commented, this has been a while back. I mean, hey, you look at Wikipedia, look at that. We're looking at the same version of the article. If we're bringing it up at the same time, you know, it might have had some kind of an edit, but basically we get to see the same version. But when it comes to Google search results, when it comes, it'll be interesting to see what ChatGPT looks like. Because it's generating new things each time. But anyway, the whole arena of Google search and search ads, it's something that I want to flesh out more in my own media literacy classes, around advertising and raising awareness of students of the ways in which advertisements work. But yeah, I think that I love being able to escape the ads. So I just wish I could do that on the iPad as well. And there's really not any way, other than YouTube Premium, I guess, to do that.
Right. Yeah. And again, I watch a lot of YouTube, and, you know, and I have certain sets of channels that I watch pretty frequently. There's about half dozen cooking channels and half dozen travel channels. And I get fed a pretty regular diet of a handful of other tech channels. But the bottom line is that makes a pretty big difference. Let me do one other quick one here, Wes, and then we could jump into this week's AI mess. This is an interesting article from TechCrunch earlier this week that's reporting that the government can't seize your data, but they can buy your data. And there is this is all spawned from the overturn of Roe versus Wade last year, and people that are seeking in states that have subsequently banned abortion to try to figure out if its citizens are going to other states to get abortions. And as it turns out, your phone tracks you and its location quite aggressively. And a lot of people start expressing concern that it would be used as some kind of vehicle for tracking women that were seeking that medical care and using it to prosecute back in their home states. And ignoring again that debate for a second, there are new rules that are preventing law enforcement proposed by the Biden administration that basically say that it can't seize data from reproductive healthcare company or from companies that have data on reproductive healthcare. And apparently that's all well and good, except that you can still buy that data from data brokers. And this turns into a bit of an expose, quoting the author, that the FBI, the military, and several other government and regulatory agencies are frequent customers of data brokers, both domestically and abroad. The data they purchase gives them alarming amounts of power to gather sensitive information on large groups of people. And that's both very interesting to me, and that's something Wes and I have talked about in the past. That in fact, I think at one point we were actually going to see if we could purchase our own data. I did read an article a couple months ago that suggested that that's exceptionally hard to do about one person. It's not impossible; it's just hard to do. But then it goes on to talk about things like the National Guard is taking advantage of this loophole by purchasing data to target and recruit high school students, and that the FBI is buying geolocation data to track millions of phones, all without needing a warrant. And, you know, the term that Dr. Farrar likes to use is surveillance capitalism, but this is surveillance capitalism gone amok.
Well, and I think it points to what we've talked about multiple times in the show, and I'm sure we'll continue to talk about. We need some privacy law in the United States. Yeah. Europe leads us with GDPR. We'll talk, I think, in the AI about Sam Altman's testimony before Congress last week. This idea of how are we going to regulate some of this tech sector, and we really, you know, need to do that. Let me do one other one that just is kind of a geeky Fediverse thing. This is TechCrunch from May 23rd. Flipboard becomes the first app to support Blue Sky, Mastodon, and PixelFed all in one place. And Dr. Neifer, I heard a rumor that you're on Blue Sky. Is it true?
I made it onto Blue Sky, thanks to my good friend Dr. Fryer sharing his the only invite he's received so far. I am now on Blue Sky, and I have to say, it is very Twitter-esque, like even adopting the color scheme and the layout of the page. But so far, and also, it doesn't seem to be a really huge place for edge of Twitter yet, right? So I've noticed, in fact, I went west to look at who you were following, and there was a couple of names, big names in there of people in the ed tech space, but the people that were following you, for example, like very few of them seemed like they were in any way associated with education. So
right. It's hard to get on, and so I've had to be on there 2 weeks but to get an invite, and then apparently every 2 weeks I'll receive another one, but it's really a small number of folks. This TechCrunch article, I'm really thrilled about this because Flipboard I've used for years, and it is absolutely one of my favorite apps on the iPad and the phone. Being able to have this visual, you know, digital newspaper experience is really superb. Twitter, of course, the bird site, cut off API access to most third-party tools, including Flipboard. So I can no longer explore my Twitter lists, which I have invested tons of hours in over time. But on the good side, we have these new tools, Mastodon being one, and both Jason and I are on Mastodon and on Blue Sky. I'm now in this habit of, for most of my ed tech things, cross posting on Blue Sky, on Mastodon, on Twitter, and I'm even posting on LinkedIn and the K-12 leaders. So anyway, I don't know how long I will keep that up, but I'm glad to see Flipboard, which is a fantastic app, supporting this. I kind of think that maybe Blue Sky has lists. I think maybe I saw something about that. It doesn't have a web interface. You have to be on the app in order to use Blue Sky, which is odd. With Mastodon, you can use the web interface. But anyway, these are decentralized platforms, and certainly this is on the cutting edge of things. But as people continue to wonder if the bird site, meaning Twitter, is going to continue to survive both financially and just in terms of its capacity, when you have centrally moderated platforms with millions and millions of people, there are some there are some big problems and some big challenges that those platforms have. And so these decentralized platforms, the founder, Jack Dorsey of Twitter, started Blue Sky, I think back in 2019. And one of the biggest things they wanted to do was form this as a decentralized platform. So you wouldn't just have a single group of folks deciding what to moderate or not. So yay, Flipboard. And if folks out there are on Blue Sky or Mastodon, please reach out. I like how Blue Sky lets you use a domain. And this is, of course, very geeky. But you can put an A record in the registrar, log into your registrar for the domain that you own. For instance, I own westfryer.com. I got a code from Blue Sky, put a text record. It's not an A record, sorry. It's a text record. And that allows to verify. So my Blue Sky account is westfryer.com. So I think that's a cool way to do verification because they've are, you know, in terms of buying domains and credibility and stuff like that, it's an interesting twist on verification. There's a different way that you can verify websites and domains that you have on Mastodon. But anyway, maybe a little bit too much about that, but I'm not on PixelFed and I don't know that I'm going to jump on that one. So.
Well, the other thing I would tell you, did you hear that Twitter didn't handle the big Ron DeSantis announcement tonight very well?
No, I didn't hear about that.
Yeah, it...
Amazingly, I wasn't with bated breath waiting for all that.
But. Yeah, the New York Times headline, DeSantis' big moment goes awry with Twitter meltdown. They apparently had... server glitches and, it didn't go so hot. And then both, Democrats, and then Donald Trump, you jumped on their various channels to trash on DeSantis. So, I don't think that went as anyone went.
Can you, I know I said we didn't want to just talk too long about these non-AI articles, but Matt, you know, the TikTok ban, which is statewide in Montana, that's a pretty big deal. And you put in the article, I think, about that not working. Would you mind talking about that one?
Yes. Well, so last week, the governor of Montana, Greg Gianforte, did sign the TikTok ban. And we've talked about it in the past, so I won't go into a lot of details there. But that article talks about the technical challenges of this. And you know, there's already lawsuits. Five creators in Montana have sued for losing access to the platform, which they say is critical for their business. TikTok itself has filed in federal court claiming its First Amendment rights were violated by the ban. But the article does talk about the challenge of this, and the Montana Attorney General, Austin Knutson, through a press person said that the concept of geofencing already exists and it shouldn't be that tough to figure out a way to do this with TikTok. And of course, geofencing, is a tool that kind of gives you some geographical cover here, but, it's just not in the way that I think they're thinking of it at working. And, you know, I would say that, I mean, I don't agree with this ban from the standpoint that I think we should have a much broader conversation about data privacy and where data is stored. That would be my argument against the ban. But I would also say that, a lot of states don't allow you to download gambling apps, for example, and they've managed to figure that out. And so, I mean, I think there's probably a technological solution to this, but it's just a big mess. And if 50 different states have 50 different lists of what apps you can download and not download, I think that becomes pretty rough pretty quick.
Let's go back to our pocket copy of the Constitution. I'm pretty sure that interstate commerce is supposed to be federally regulated. And I also think, you know, issues of national defense and national security, national issues, federal issues, not, you know, states. We're not going to rely on the Montana militia to defend us against the threat posed by, you know, China in Taiwan or something. So I think that this is probably, going to be sorted out by the courts, and for a variety of reasons, starting with the Constitution, this is going to be something that I think federal voices are going to weigh in on versus state ones. But it is interesting, as you point out, with what's happening with gambling apps. So who knows? Yep.
Absolutely. Okay, Dr. Fryer, we've reached the AI hour, so let's go ahead and get through this week's mess. So I guess I would start off with just kind of my own personal piece of AI world this week. I've been experimenting with all sorts of things this week. I am trying to be a little more cautious about, you know, where I use it from the standpoint of, I do think the writing it creates, and I would agree with a lot of teachers and professors I've seen write about this, is that it's not great writing. It sometimes is pretty good writing, and it does a good job of helping you rewrite writing or also spot errors inside of a particular piece. But the bottom line is that, you know, it's really no replacement for, you know, actually learning to write or writing well. And I think that's an important piece of this. But One of the things that's not on here is that OpenAI has released its own ChatGPT app on the iOS platform. And the reason why this is important is because there were hundreds, if not thousands, of apps that in many cases cost money or had in-app purchases that were essentially a front for the OpenAI ChatGPT platform or use the API, but were really just there to take your money. And so now there's a free app available. I downloaded almost immediately, and now gives me ChatGPT access on my phone.
I've been using it as well. My only AI article this week, basically... It's Hard Fork, and we've talked about this a bunch of times on the show. Their latest episode from last Friday, Mr. Altman Goes to Washington. But also, and did you listen to this one, Jason, with the Casey Goes on This American Life? Man, this is absolutely fantastic. The summary, so as probably a lot of us know now, Sam Altman, one of the most important leaders in the technology world, testified before Congress, as Casey Newton and Kevin Ruse point out, and this, they're, you know, Kevin's with the New York Times. He's the one that had the whole interaction with Sydney a few weeks ago that caused, caused Microsoft, you know, to get a lot of egg on its face by rushing to integrate ChatGPT. I think obviously before it was proven and they had to go, you know, put additional requirements and limits on it. They talked about how Altman's approach as the CEO of OpenAI is very different than what we saw from Sundar Pichai of Google and Mark Zuckerberg from Meta, Facebook, Jeff Bezos and Amazon, because those folks were very distant. Altman has made himself very accessible. The tenor and tone of these interactions between congressmen and Mr. Altman is frankly, quite positive. And I agree with what they said. It took like 6 years to get some testimony or hearings, I guess, at Congress about social media. And then when we did, there was just a lot of posturing and nothing actually happened. There was no legislation. But the stakes really do appear to be different with artificial intelligence. And Altman is asking for regulation. You know, the thing they clarified there, because he was asked pretty point blank. I mean, if you had a magic wand, you were queen for the day, what would you do? And so what he is asking for is a regulatory agency that can regulate AI, especially when it crosses certain boundaries. The whole thing with biology, proteins, medicines, virology, viruses, there are all kinds of quite dystopian possibilities for these tools, which are just, you know, again, sort of in their early days. So this was really, really a fantastic podcast episode, as I think pretty much all of Hard Fork is. But then the Casey Newton segment, they just play it from This American Life, and it's his interview and deep dive into the person at Twitter that was handling content moderation before and after Elon Musk took over. And absolutely fascinating. And I do think it's very important from a civic standpoint that we're talking about free speech and how free speech is limited. And at some stage, you know, from a technology standpoint too, you just don't want to have unfettered free speech on any platform because it becomes a dumpster fire. And so anyway, there's a lot of really good insights into kind of what happened at Twitter before Musk, you know, during Musk's takeover, and then afterwards, and then ultimately the person who he interviews, I'm trying to see his name, the former head of trust and safety, Yoel Roth. Ultimately, he had to resign because, you know, the changes that Twitter was making, you know, with respect to verification, you know, the proliferation of impersonation and just the cutbacks, anyway, had reached a point where he had to resign. So phenomenal, wonderful podcast for so many reasons.
Yeah, it's so interesting. I really, 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 really want to listen to that. I want to share an article from The Verge on May 16th that is super interesting. this is the CNET staff are unionizing, citing editorial independence and the use of AI tools. And, they have about 100 people that are trying to, unionize, for the purpose of a lot of reasons, I would imagine. But, you know, as they say in their press release, in this time of instability, our diverse content teams need industry standard job protections, fair compensation, and editorial independence, and a voice in the decision making process, especially as automated, technology threatens our jobs and reputations. And the reason why that is interesting to me is because there is a very similar conversation going on right now, around the writer's strike, the Writers Guild of America strike, because of, in some cases, and there's a lot of reasons why the Writers Guild says they're striking, but they are worried that they are also going to be replaced by AI, and lose the creative touch that goes into, most major, television productions and motion pictures. And I do think, with what is happening to newspapers and magazines and news sites in the United States, it's going to be very hard to do this only through unionizing, but I could understand why professional writers would be concerned that their jobs are just going to start getting picked off one by one in exchange for a chatbot.
How much displacement do you think we're going to see in the white collar job market?
A lot. And unfortunately, I don't think, I think there's going to be a lot of upheaval in the next couple of years, even though the tools themselves aren't really going to do the job people think they're going to do. And I think one of the things, that I think is troublesome here is that some of the switches may happen and, we may not know the transition or start to just accept lower quality content without, and we may just not know the difference for a little while, right? And it becomes kind of a dumbing down of content or a lower quality of content. And then I think we end up in a weird impasse for a while because we don't really know what to do about that, or the content's so cheap, it's hard to start paying people again. I mean, one of the things that I want to be, really cognizant of is that, you know, newspapers made a really big mistake 25 years ago by giving their content away for free online, right? And even though I love that about newspapers 25 years ago, the bottom line is that it killed that model. Right. The same is true of magazines. The same is true in some cases of news television. But what I have to wonder is, you know, can we use those lessons to make good decisions on behalf of what we'll allow AI to do and what we won't allow AI to do?
And I mean, there is a lot of room for individual creators. I know that you, Jason, are supporting, I think, a number of different creators, you know, Patreon, there's Substack, you know, payment mechanisms, for different creators. So I wonder to the degree we're going to just move into a different era of journalism where, you know, individual journalists are going to, you know, find a way to pay the bills because of, these micropayment platforms. But maybe, you know, the thing that we've talked about before is local news, right? You've talked about Montana as far as just not a super populous state and, you know, not a ton of local news coverage before internet. Now post internet, there's even less. So I don't know what the gap, who is going to fill the gap with respect to local news. I'd like to think maybe that's a role for students to play a role in, whether they're high school or, you know, community college, four-year college. I don't know, but, you know, obviously professional journalists are the ones who can best cover the news and the nuance of it and, you know, get breaking stories and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, we've been in a very interesting age because of the consolidation of media companies and all these different, you know, companies buying all sorts of folks, but I'll just put another plug in for not only media literacy, but specifically lateral reading, because right now, when it comes to local sources, as well as, you know, national news, you've got some really weird domains and organizations. And so being able to ask the question, wait a second, where is this coming from? How do I find out? Don't just go to the about page. And I had a student this week, and I've never said this before, but they actually put in a video. If it's a .gov or a .edu site, you can rely on it. Well, anyway, EDU sites, you know, students have had lots of homepages and things that they could put on those. And that's just generally not what we should be telling students today, is like, well, just, you know, trust a .org site, but don't maybe trust a .com. The inquiry has got to go, it's got to go further than that. The domain level. You know, whatever the domain is, it's not going to be able to give it authenticity. So,
yep. Well, here's a play on the future. This is an article from The Hill on May 22nd. The market dips briefly, says Jason, after AI image of fake explosion near Pentagon goes viral. And there was a group of Twitter accounts that were verified, right? And since verified doesn't mean jack squat anymore, it was, you know, hard to tell the difference between that and a major news outlet. And they were mimicking, I think, Bloomberg, if I remember correctly. Yes, Bloomberg News, called the Bloomberg feed. And the headline was initial report, large explosion near the Pentagon complex in Washington, D.C., initial report. And the photo itself, and I've seen a copy of the photo, showed a smoke rising from a building that looked vaguely like the Pentagon. And shortly after the image went viral, the market showed a brief dip, with the Dow Jones Industrial Average falling about 80 points and the S&P 500 down 0.26%, according to CNN Politico. The interruption to the market was brief, occurring only for a few minutes. And yeah, yikes. I mean, you know, it's not hard to create these images anymore. You can create some pretty realistic looking images on Midjourney, but we have to stop now with the rule that seeing is believing, right? You need multiple sources from a variety of news sources in order to believe something is true or factual.
I don't know that we have this article in here, and I just remember, yeah, here it is. Did you hear about this Meta $1.3 billion EU settlement?
No.
Okay, so again, listening to these different podcasts, this, and we'll dip out of the out of AI for just a minute. This is a CNN article from so many tabs. I'm Googling too many things. CNN Business. This is on May 22nd. Meta slapped with record $1.3 billion EU fine over data privacy. This eclipses all previous records of fines that the EU has levied so far. And they are saying that the EU privacy laws, GDPR, have been violated because Facebook/Meta has been illegally transferring the personal data of Facebook users to servers in the United States. I think we've talked about this on the show before. GDPR puts some pretty significant burdens on companies, and in some ways sort of challenges really fundamentals of the internet, which is that, hey, it doesn't matter, you know, where your server is. It's the internet, so you're going to be able to access it. It says, hey, it does matter, because they've said European citizen data, you know, has to be housed in Europe. So this was the largest fine ever levied under GDPR. The previous record of $805.7 million was levied against Amazon in 2021. And they've been ordered, Meta has, to cease the processing of personal data of European users within 6 months. So again, the differences between Europe and the United States. Europe has privacy law. You know, we don't. Is this going to make an impact on Meta? I don't know. I think until we see some privacy laws in the United States, I don't know if we're going to see any significant changes as far as behavior and things like that. But that was a pretty big deal.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's see here. Here's an interesting one. This is from SSRN, which is a research journal, and this is from that Ethan Mullick that we've talked about in the past. He's got a great Twitter account, and he writes this really interesting paper with another professor from the University of Pennsylvania Wharton School, which is basically or it describes it as effective teaching strategies in the classroom using AI with prompts that they use to be able to create it. And I thought this was really interesting because I don't know what I think about, you know, using AI to grade, for example, right? Interesting tools out there. I've played with it a little bit myself with rubrics, but it's sometimes interesting to highlight things, right? It's probably not there yet. But he does show at you screenshots from all the major tools and creates, a lot of material based on, you know, teaching materials in class and then shares you the prompts to do it. And so it's things like, here's an example prompt for ChatGPT or GPT-4 or Bing. I am a teacher who wants to understand what students found most important about my class when they are confused by it. Review these responses and identify common themes and patterns in student responses. Summarize responses and list the three key points students found most important about the class and three areas of confusion. And then they copy and paste student responses into here, and it analyzes them to find, you know, similarities and ways that they are diverse from one another. And I think that kind of thing, imagine that in a focused tool that purports to do these things for you or for teachers. I think this could be incredibly interesting diagnostic tools for teachers.
Absolutely. Are you a Photoshop user?
I have Photoshop. I use it occasionally. I am not a good Photoshop user.
I am out of GIF links, actually, for the New York Times, so I don't have a GIF link for that. Maybe we can drop one in. But this was New York Times yesterday on May 23rd. AI Photoshopping is about to get very easy, maybe too easy. And so basically the generative AI capabilities that we have talked about multiple times on the show are now integrated right into Photoshop. And so they have a series of pictures that the author Farhad Manju created that, you know, do some interesting things, putting arms in where they weren't there before, additional birds, putting other artifacts into a skyline picture, but removing things. So a city picture where there's a car passing, there's a skateboarder, there's a wall, and so they've got like an animated GIF that kind of shows, you know, removing the blurry scooter and the car, to just, you know, highlight this delivery guy. And so anyway, those tools are built right in. The most significant thing about this article, and I had not heard of this before, Jason, is that Adobe is pioneering a watermarking tool, which they are hopeful will receive broad acceptance within industry and just worldwide. And it's going to be a way of being able to basically have a breadcrumb history of where a photograph came from. And so if there was AI modifications, the idea is that, you know, it's going to be revealed because of this tool. So it is called, it says 1,000 tech and media companies have joined in the initiative, including camera makers like Canon, Nikon, Leica, Microsoft, NVIDIA. And then they've got a link to it. And it's just, the website is contentauthenticity.org. And I'll put a link to that in as well. So I know that you are trying to attribute whenever you're using AI, and that's something that we've talked about that is a best practice that we need to be doing as academics. But this is interesting that this is an actual standard that Adobe is pioneering and hoping that others in the industry are going to get behind.
Okay. This is an article that I think we mentioned briefly last release. I think I referred to last week. This is from Future, the Byte on futurism.com, which is kind of an AI news aggregate site that I think has been pretty interesting in pointing out articles. But they talk about a pretty influential newspaper, the Irish Times, ran an editorial in its opinion section and said that it was submitted to them and it was completely AI generated and completely made up. And they post a they posted a retraction and an apology, but I just can't imagine that this is not going to get a lot worse pretty quickly, right? And again, I have no solutions to this, other than to say we really, really need to ramp up our media literacy coverage immediately, to help students kind of process through it. But, you know, especially as the AI gets better, which it will almost certainly, there's going to be a lot of instances like this where stuff ends up in papers. Maybe it's innocuous and maybe it's not, that could really stir up some unpleasant things politically. And it's just really unfortunate we're going to what I would imagine is one of the most important elections, in recent memory next year, whereas we have this possibility that a bunch of content could get generated, that's really not generated by any human person.
And I think that was the case where the person said they wanted to poke the bear, stir the pot, you know, and they were, the newspaper actually discovered it because of the author's, you know, confession on Twitter, that they had done this. So yeah, what is the solution if you are running an op-ed desk? Other than, I guess, having somebody come in person and maybe hand write in front of you their op-ed. I mean, how are you going to do the verification there to make sure that what's being given to you wasn't created with some kind of an AI tool?
Yeah, totally.
Let's see. I guess I'm seeing a couple that are carried through. This one was from a couple weeks ago, but this is the lead one on there, which is a gift link. Microsoft says new AI shows signs of human reasoning. It's just, you know, we used to have the Turing test, which said, hey, if you could be tricked into thinking that you're interacting with a computer and not a human, you know, then, or if the computer can trick you and make you think like you're interacting with a human. And I think ChatGPT definitely says that. This is interesting for several reasons. One of them, there are researchers at Microsoft. And so the critics are saying, well, obviously Microsoft is heavily invested in OpenAI, you know, basically saying this, the authors are corrupted, you know, because they're not impartial or neutral. But they had given this AI system a puzzle that they thought would require an intuitive understanding of the world. And so it described, here we have a book, 9 eggs, a laptop, a bottle, and a nail. Please tell me how to stack them onto each other in a stable manner. And the AI system was very, you know, had a lot of ingenuity and came up with a way to do that. And so anyway, this is interesting because it's sort of like getting not really to the sentience level, but certainly to the creativity level, and just also trying to ascertain the depth of understanding. Anyway, I was having a conversation today with someone who was talking about, as we're sort of arguing and wondering about that, oh, you know, does it have these capabilities? You know, to what degree does it have, and then, you know, will it have ethics? Will the AIs have, you know, any kind of values? How are you going to know they're not tricking you? There's just so many different layers to this. But anyway, certainly Microsoft and OpenAI are benefiting a lot from all of the hoopla that is surrounding all of this. And I think I have the link in from last week, but that Naomi Klein article it's definitely the most critical one that I have read to date, about some of the claims and things like that. Have you checked out this, is it called Stochastic Parrots, or what is the Gebru, who is the Google AI researcher that left because of charges about the racist? Have you tracked with that, or are you following her program?
No.
Okay. That is, yes, Stochastic Parrots, which that means repetition of phrases. But anyway, that's the organization that she has. And I don't know. I think we probably ought to make sure that we're giving some good hearing we are paying attention to some of these critical voices as well, because, you know, certainly there's a lot of excitement and people that are being very positive about all this, but there are definitely some good critical voices out there that we need to pay attention to.
Yep, absolutely.
I'll put the link to this one in there. This is a paper called On the Dangers of Stochastic Parrots: Can Language Models Be Too Big? And this is an article that Gebru wrote with several others. I'll admit I haven't read this yet, but those are some of the arguments that, and one of the voices that we should pay attention to.
I might be AI'd out.
What? It's never happened before, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, let me comment on one other thing. I've seen a number of articles in the last 3 or 4 weeks people that I trust are good, thoughtful people that are not trying to put the brakes on AI or artificially slow it down, but rather just wants to be thoughtful about it. One of the things they say is that anytime you hear the phrase, you know, like ChatGPT, so yesterday, this is the new tool, or the folks that are running around with old school .com rhetoric about 10xing things, right? That's just not a healthy growth, even though it's happening really fast. I think we need to be really careful about the hype here. And
yeah, that's what I was trying to say. Yep.
Yeah. It's coming to your classrooms this fall for sure. But do you need to embrace it wholly in your classroom? Otherwise be a behind teacher? Well, of course not. Right. The conversations that need to happen have nothing to do with, yes or no. It has to do with how we're going to inform ourselves and how we're going to inform our students about the changes that are about to come. Not necessarily embracing it as a tool useful in every assignment or every class. In fact, I think if anything, there's a lot of ways that AI harms learning, by how we know people learn. But if we don't start having those conversations in a way that's not just stuck on blocking and blocking only, then we're going to miss out an opportunity to embrace this in a good, useful way, as opposed to a dangerous or disastrous way.
Yeah. Agreed. Have you heard of Whisper as a voice transcription tool?
No.
So Whisper was developed by OpenAI, and I don't, I can put this introducing Whisper. This was September of 2022, but it is completely local and it is really, really small. And it's also phenomenally powerful. So with just recording a short amount of your voice, you can, you know, have a functional model that's going to be able to, you know, replicate your voice in all kinds of ways. So it's called Whisper. You can Google Whisper by OpenAI. I'll do this article real quick that I think I had from last week. This is 9to5Mac on May 16th. Apple's new personal voice feature can create a voice that sounds like you or a loved one in just 15 minutes. So evidently with Whisper, it can be a lot less, but there are a bunch of different tools like this. Again, on the Clockwise podcast this morning, they mentioned one called 11 Labs, which I have not heard of before, but I'm considering for some of the book projects that I'll be working on this summer, you know, rather than reading the whole thing and putting it out on Audible, how reasonable is it to be able to use one of these tools, train it on my voice, and then be able to have an audio version of a book that is synthetically generated, you know, with an AI tool. So anyway, glad to see Apple putting that in. One of the things that Apple is doing for this isn't so that we can all put out our own eBooks with a synthetic voice, but folks with ALS and other kinds of disabilities that limit speech, this allows people to be able to have recorded messages in their voice and be able to key those in conversations, and is an accessibility feature that is really pretty phenomenal. So this is being included in the next version of iOS, and Apple has always been a leader when it comes to accessibility. But that's a whole genre, and I don't know to what degree, Jason, you're tracking that. But as far as the AI tools allowing for, you know, synthetic voice generation, we've almost got 300 podcasts here now on the show. So as an example, you know, we might be able to point these tools to our shows and say, hey, you know, create the voice of Dr. Neifer. But to the point about elections and all those things that are coming up, there are just so many tools, and many of these are openly available, that can be used to manufacture all kinds of media. So the human voice, certainly lots of text, even video, the article that you said this week about the stock market dipping when there was a generated picture of an explosion at the Pentagon. I'm afraid these are just the signs of things to come. So, well, we have made it to the top of the hour, Dr. Neifer. We did start off, and I probably didn't even say that at the start, but that was my fault. I was having to make a brisket run tonight to the grocery store, and so we were a little bit late getting started. Any last articles you'd like to hit before Geeks of the Week?
No, just looking here, I think we did a pretty good healthy trip at the whole list. So
sounds good. Well, I'll do mine quickly. Seamless clipboard. Hadn't used this before, but have a, I guess it's a 2015 MacBook that's still okay. But thanks to your advice, Jason, I have tried Google OS Flex, Google Chrome OS Flex. And so got a 16 gig flash drive. Of course, couldn't install that on my school computer since I don't have an admin account, but I borrowed my wife's computer, got that set up, and, you know, boom, it's installed and running fast. And so the Seamless Clipboard is available for, on the Chrome Web Store, available as a Chrome extension. You can get it for Android on Google Play, and you can get it for iOS. And what it allows you to do is very easily copy and paste links and other kinds of content between your devices. So I hadn't been using a Chromebook a lot. Now I'm using one a little bit, and I thought, oh, I want a way to be able to send my links over. And because incidentally, when I'm doing my social media posts, I use the Apple Notes app, kind of like I used to use Evernote. It's just so easy. And so I'll compose there with hashtags and everything like that, and then cross post that in different places. But if I get the link from the Chromebook, I need a way to get that over to my phone, and the Seamless Clipboard is free, and it's a quick way to do that.
Great. That's really cool, actually. And then I want to share, and I'm decently sure I've shared this one before, but I pretty constantly have websites that would like me to share an email address to get access to an article or maybe a free guide or something for people that are marketers. And I have this particular a tool just in my toolbar. It's called TempMail. TempMail allows you to create an ad hoc email address and shows you the inbox right there. And then you can refresh it, and then it will show you the email, so you can click on it to get a link or something, and then you close the email box and it goes away.
You have not shared this because I would remember it. This is really cool.
Yeah, it's super cool. And there are times when, you know, that, and I'm a lot more hesitant. I mean, I've had the same email address now for basically 20 years. So, you know, there's a lot of junk in my email, but I try to avoid sharing my address whenever possible. And tempmail.org is one of the tools I use to do that.
That's awesome. All right. Well, where can folks find you, Dr. Neifer, when you are not here so thoroughly covering the world of AI and educational technology for everyone?
Well, the best place to find me is probably still Twitter, TechSavvyTeach, but I'm also Neif, N-E-I-F, at Blue Sky.
There you go. For the three people out there that are educators on Blue Sky. I am Wes Fryer, westfryer.com/after. I'll probably update that a little bit, but most of my social media profiles are there. And this has been the EdTech Situation Room. We are a weekly podcast, normally broadcasting at 9 p.m. Central, 6 p.m. Pacific, or sorry, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific on Wednesday evenings, sometimes offset a little bit. And if you follow us on Facebook or Twitter, that is where we'll generally share an update if we're going to have to move a show or cancel a show. We will say that in the summer months, we sometimes have some travel. I know Dr. Neifer is planning an Icelandic experience, and that is going to be coming up. And so we'll probably have at least a few times where we may not be online, but generally we are, and you can find MP3 compressed versions of audio only shows, as well as all of our show notes and then links to our video versions on edtechsr.com. You can also follow us on YouTube, and anywhere fine our podcasts are curated, you should be able to find us. And if you have an opportunity to leave a 5-star review for us, that would be wonderful. Until next time, we encourage you to stay savvy, stay safe, and keep playing with your generative AI tools, because there's probably no better way to figure out what these mean for us than by playing with them, especially in areas in which you have some personal expertise.